Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Oh, such a deep, deep pleasure to be here, you know, with so many old, beloved Dharma friends and new ones, too, and just feeling the family way, the family resemblance, you know? Yeah, just delightful. And, you know, as I was sitting before coming in here, I could really feel Joan strongly present. You know, in a maybe a different way than I have before. Maybe more like an ancestor, you know? But a strong and bright and vivid and warm one, you know, not like something distant. But, you know, like she would talk about it, like somebody who's there to support your practice. You know, people you can rely on. And, you know, I could really feel the way that we're all relying on her and her practice and her ancestry as we're here together this week. And just that we can, you know, we can kind of fall back into that, which is just a lovely, I don't know, it's a lovely feeling. So this koan is really interesting and a little unusual in that it really invites us to take our vivid emotional life as a Dharma gate. That can be the seat of our practice. And so we have this this woman who is grief-stricken, you know, and aren't we all, right? You know, everybody in this room is dealing with loss, everybody, and grief, and change, and uncertainty. And so often when we sit down to meditate, you know, that can be what's most vividly apparent, you know, to us, is our own suffering and the poignancy of that. And so her teacher was able to really see that her grief itself was not something to transcend in that moment, but it was something to actually completely become intimate with. And that was his instruction to her, his practice instruction, is the heart of the one who asks is Zen. That's it. Your heart. You know? Your raggedy-ass heart. Your confused heart. You know, your upside-down heart, your broken heart. That one. Yeah, that one. So, you know, it's an interesting invitation. So I want to talk some tonight about the practice of the heart. What does that actually look like? What do we actually do? And really, what is the heart anyway? There's the sort of personal heart, the heart of the one who asks. But there's, later on in the koan, there's another heart that comes in, and that's the Heart Sutra. So I want to follow that transition from the heart of the one who asks, you know, your grief-stricken heart, to the heart of the Heart Sutra, and see what they have to do with each other. You know, I think for many, maybe most of us, a lot of our time in meditation is spent working with difficult emotional states. And especially early in practice, I mean, we can just, that can be the whole thing for years, maybe decades, you know? That could be the main thing. It's like a, sort of like a karmic reckoning, all the things you've tried to run away from. You know, when you sit down and shut up, you can't really run away anymore, so you kind of have to just deal with it, right? So there's this sort of fire that we can need to sit with and find a way to be in relationship to. And that's the practice. How can I be in a skillful relationship to my heart? To the territory of my heart. And, you know, I think in many ways the fundamental move to working with emotional states in practice is to start to really, really feel vividly alive the energetic state of it, like the vividness, you know, the texture of it. You know, what exactly does it feel like? Can you get all the way inside of it? And at the very same time, can you drop your story about it? You know, the habitual story that gets attached, which is usually about how somebody is bad. Could be you, could be somebody else. So, you know, we just start to notice. We notice these stories. It's just like a gnat that annoys you and flies around and doesn't leave you alone. But it doesn't make it true or real. And dealing with an emotion on an energetic level is a different thing from dealing with the secondary, you know, the secondary, right? The story that we attach. That's the suffering part. The story that we attach. You know, I don't deserve good things, or bad things will always happen to me, or I'm unlovable. You know, the certain certainties that we attach. So what we can start to do in our practice, and this is the heart of the one who asks, is to just simply be in the constantly arising and falling away energetic state of an emotional response. And as we do that, you know, things start to get a little bigger. You know, we find a little more space. We don't feel quite as closed in and terrified of our emotions. And that helps us to just have a different relationship to them. You know, as far as I can tell, and if anybody has a different experience, let me know, it's not like difficult emotions ever end. But it's really how can we relate to that in a way that doesn't perpetuate suffering for ourselves and others. So that's just the basic movement of working with the heart, you know, the practice of the heart, the personal heart. And there's no skipping that. That's the other thing, is I think a lot of us come to practice with the agenda of just transcending the messy business of the heart. You know, we want to just, you know, skip straight to Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. You know, and get out of the muck, get out of the grief, the fear, you know, the rage. And this koan, this teacher really points us to going, you know, all the way in and through the practice of the heart instead of trying to skip it. And this is, you know, what we call spiritual bypassing, which is the tendency of practitioners to want to not do the difficult and messy work of the heart and the relationships, and instead to use spiritual practice as a way to sort of transcend the need to do that. So this koan is really an invitation to not bypass, to actually find the gate of the heart as a Dharma gate for our practice. And that's an invitation for all of us for this week. So as we sit with our emotional life, the most important thing, you know, is to be present without judgment and really to be noticing that story. And to really let it unfurl. It's like there's a feeling of movement about a real kind of unfolding emotional state. And can we allow for that movement? Can we just show up for that? And there's a feeling when we do that of a kind of a transformation. So it really becomes a transformational process. And it's a kind of alchemy. You know, back in the old days, they thought that, you know, the original alchemy was to turn straw into gold, right? So you take something that seems really worthless or difficult, and you can transform that into something that is incredibly precious. And when we sit in the middle of the hellfires, I think of there's a tanka with the hell realms, and there's a little Buddha sitting right there in the middle of the fire. You know, and sometimes it can feel like that in our practice. We're just sitting in the hellfire, you know, of a difficult, difficult state. And we're just in it. We're just in it. And we notice our habit to want to flee it or fix it or check out. And we see if we can find just that little piece of us that can just surrender, just be. And as we find our way to do that, we find that a kind of a transformation does take place. Something becomes more burnished, more sturdy. We find a larger space that's available to us where we can be out of the, not out of, but not always subject to the intense winds of emotional states, but rather in a place of watching that rise and fall. And as we bear witness to that rising and falling, it kind of naturally and organically can lead us to, you know, a bigger question of, you know, who is this suffering self? Who is this person who is subject to these storms, these intense patterns of habitual response, of just what can feel like unending attacks or evasions? We start to see the ways that we hold our heart as hard. And we wonder, you know, who is this person? And that then it becomes a bigger question. Something bigger starts to happen. You know, I want to talk just a minute. I've been reading and teaching about the relationship between trauma and meditation lately. And I wanted to say a few things about that because I think it is related to the heart of the one who asks. And this woman's heart was traumatized. She had lost her, it sounds like, a very beloved husband at a very young age, we could imagine, unexpectedly. And one way or another, I would say that we all have some trauma that we bring to our meditation practice. For some of us, it's like a capital T trauma, you know, like a terrible thing that happened or a bunch of terrible stuff that happened. And for some of us, it's more, kind of low grade, what I would think of as like relational trauma, you know, childhood stuff, even if you had a pretty good childhood, you know, the things that just accumulate, the things that happen. And what happens when we sit down is that a lot of that comes up. And so to one degree or another, many of us are dealing with some kind of a traumatic state when we sit down to meditate. And it can be helpful just to start to recognize if that's true for you, and if it is true, in what sort of way it's true. It tends to be there's two main ways that this can show up, you know, trauma. And this is a gross oversimplification of something that is, you know, fairly complex. But one way that we respond to a trauma is to hyper-react. We get overstimulated. So we get very emotional, we get very agitated, or very, you know, our thoughts go wild. You know, we can, it can happen in different ways, but our whole system is sort of dysregulated and overstimulated. And it feels like it's hard to settle. It feels like something is out of control, something can feel chaotic, in whatever sort of system of the body-mind that takes place. And, you know, many people, when we come to meditation, you know, we struggle with this. We struggle with overwhelming states of one kind or another. And when that's happening, you know, the most skillful thing is to really keep it simple, keep it breath-focused, grounded, slow, you know, to really just slow down and simplify. The other thing that we can bring to meditation is a tendency to check out, to escape. We can be really dissociate. We can use meditation. Meditation is a great way to pretend that you're meditating, but you're actually just checked out. You know, that's possible. A way to escape difficult feelings. A way to sort of try to cultivate something that looks like, you know, a deep meditative state, but maybe something, you know, that's more of a defense, more of a way of keeping difficulty at bay. And, you know, sometimes in meditation this can be sort of a chronic stuckness or a flatness. Or, you know, just really chronic kind of sleepiness or laxness or kind of apathy, just sort of feeling not engaged. So, you know, it can be helpful just to be able to recognize if, you know, something like this is happening in our heart, you know, as we're practicing. So, you know, really this first gate, the gate of the heart of the one who asks is Zen, is the gate of using our emotional life as a way, first to tolerate what happens to us emotionally, to tolerate our experience, you know, to accept and even start to love, you know, and find compassion for our experience, which then naturally extends out. It spreads, it can't help it. You know, it's just its nature. It bleeds. And that's where, you know, we get into this bigger question of, you know, whose suffering is this anyway? This isn't just mine. We start to really notice that. You know, I do not corner the market on grief or aging or sickness or loss. You know, that's why we're here. We're all in it together. And that just expands the heart, you know, and that heart gets really big. And it leads to this feeling, you know, we call bodhicitta, you know, the aspiration to awaken for all beings, not just for ourselves. You know, it's that heart of just a sort of a natural compassion. It's not something we ever have to try to force. It just happens naturally when we see things as they really are. So this process of transformation, of alchemy, requires a vessel. And in the koan, you know, we have a bucket, which is sort of the archetypal cauldron. You know, the witch's kettle, the vessel in which a transformational process happens. And in any good alchemical process, there is a need for a sturdy cauldron. And of course, at first, the bucket is just that. It holds the water so perfectly. You know, in the moon, and there it is, how lovely, the moon perfectly held in the bucket. And as we gather here today, over the last day, we're forming our own cauldron, our own container. You know, a vessel that is strong and sturdy enough to hold our transformation, our alchemy. Because we rely on each other, we're creating a field of all of our practice. So many years of practice in here, so much love, so much care, and we're knitting and weaving it together into a field that can hold anything for any of us. And that's an amazing blessing to have that together. Of course, any good vessel is made to be broken. And the bottom does fall out of the bucket. But I'm interested in a certain moment in the koan where the teacher actually changes his approach. His first teaching was the heart of the one who asks is Zen. So then she has, you know, she hears the deer and she, you know, has some kind of an opening and writes this poem, which he glances at, right? And then he offers his second teaching, which is different. Read the Heart Sutra. So he's still on about the heart. But read the Heart Sutra has a different feel for, you know, what's in your heart. So what's up with that? And what does the Heart Sutra have to do with the heart anyway? You know, the Heart Sutra is probably the most well-known Buddhist teaching on, you know, what we call emptiness, which is kind of a difficult word, but maybe we could call it, instead of just using that word emptiness, we could call it interdependence. We could call it transitoriness. We could call it sort of lack of any separate individual being. You know, so there's no separation. Emptiness sounds kind of like a void, and that's really not what this is about. It's about a feeling of no separation, no dualism. And so in this sense, the Heart Sutra is talking about sort of our most fundamental heart, you know, not just our personal heart, our personal story, but a heart that's so much bigger than that, the heart that we share, that's so much bigger than anything that we can imagine. It's the heart that happens when the bottom does drop out of the bucket. So the practice of the Heart Sutra, you know, is really the practice of seeing things as they really are, which is not dual, not two. To whatever you think, not no. It's the practice of no, of negation, of pulling the rug out from under. And in the course of doing that, you know, what is revealed is just, you know, a tremendous awareness of, because we're so interconnected, that we cannot not feel our heart is so much bigger than that any one of our individual hearts. And that when we can really feel that and really share that awareness, it's such a relief. You know, we don't have to carry it alone. We don't have to be a superhero. We don't have to figure it out. You know, we don't have to just be really good. We don't have to even be good meditators, thank goodness. You know, we can just feel the unfolding of, you know, of the heart that we share. So that moment where Bukko changed his teaching was a moment after the student had written this poem that I read as a little staid, right? She's gotten this little bit of insight, and so she's sort of got her, she's preciously holding her bucket and her moon, and everything's kind of careful and balanced, and it all looks really nice. But so, of course, you know, it needs to be upended. And so that's his prescription, you know. Okay, so now you have had contact with the heart of the one who asks. Now let's pull the rug out from under that. And it points to a place in our practice when we do need to do the necessary personal healing, and we also need to know when we're getting stuck in something about that, and we need to upend that. And how the skillful means is to not do that prematurely, because that's a way that we can use to skip things that we don't like. But also to start to recognize, and this is where it's really helpful to have teachers and spiritual friends, you know, when we're getting stuck in a sort of an emotional dead end, which it seems like maybe she had gotten into a little bit with that first poem. Just one reading. So the natural emotional response to an awareness of interdependence, which is the teaching of the Heart Sutra, the teaching of emptiness, when you see that, the emotional response is just naturally one of compassion. And that feeling of compassion is sort of a universal solvent. You know, it's whatever it comes into contact with, it softens. Whatever pain you have, whatever loss you have, whatever grief you have, whatever joy you have, you know, bringing an awareness of compassion to it will make it so much richer and deeper and broader. And that's, you know, the transformation of the koan. So part of the koan way is that the koans help us develop what I think of as binocular vision. So it's like we're seeing through two eyes at the same time, just like with binoculars. And with one eye, we keep our eye on the heart of the one who asks, your heart. You know, in its particularity, in its poignancy, in its vulnerability, you know, in its confusion. And exactly as it is, one eye trained on that with a lot of curiosity and kindness. And then the other eye is the Heart Sutra eye, you know, the big picture. You know, the awareness of our interdependence, an awareness that we're so much bigger than our personal sorrow. And when we can see at the same time, through each of those eyes, you know, that both things are true. We don't have to choose. We really don't. We can actually really, in our practice, be with the heart, your heart, the heart of the one who asks. And also with the vast heart. The heart of the Heart Sutra, the heart of emptiness, and not in a cold way, in a very warm-hearted way, and that's how practice becomes mature and develops a texture, you know, a depth, sort of like that nubbiness, you know, like in a good fabric, you know, where there's something interesting going on. The weave isn't just all one thing. You know, there's weird glitches and colors and ways things come together and a beautiful sheen, and it all, you know, weaves together. And that's um, that's a practice of the heart that I think it's sort of a true practice. It's you know, in the last poem, the later poet talks about the humble woman's bucket. You know, and I think that that's one of the qualities that this kind of practice can give rise to, is just that quality of humility. Because, you know, sure, we can have insights and practice, but it doesn't make us better. In fact, what it makes us aware of is, you know, just welcome to the human race. You know, we're all in it together. You know, that knows whole society. So yes, that humble woman, and you know, our humble practice and our sincere practice and our practice of the heart.